Reggie Watts is an internationally renowned musician, comedian, and writer who starred as the band leader on CBS's The Late Late Show with James Corden and IFC's comedy Bang Bang. Using nothing but his voice, his looping pedals, and his vast imagination, Watts blurs the lines between music and comedy with a resume that includes multiple specials and appearances across platforms such as Comedy Central and Netflix. And he's just written a fascinating memoir about the first part of his life. It's called Great Falls, Montana, Fast Times, Post-Punk Weirdos, and A Tale of Coming Home Again. Reggie, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, yeah. Just hanging in there, having fun, I think.
That's good to hear. So your book is a fascinating one. I guess the starting point is this. You're not an old guy by any means. So why did you decide to write your first memoir, which came out a little bit earlier this year?
Gosh, I don't know. Well, because I wanted to get my high school experience documented so that I might be able to make a movie or a series from it.
How is that coming along so far, that part of the process?
It hasn't really started, but you know, it's just a matter of getting it together. I think it'll start. I think we'll take it more seriously in the new year.
Gotcha. Well, good luck with that. Now, you come from a very unique background, African-American father who's in the U.S. military, and as you put it, a very French mother, someone who embraced her Frenchness. They met overseas. You were born overseas before your family eventually moves to the title city of Great Falls, Montana. Though your mom maintained that fierce French spirit, she insisted that you become American citizen as soon as y'all moved to the U.S., which you did. And that kind of empowered you as this shy kid to try and branch out a little bit in your neighborhood. So immediately after you get your U.S. citizenship, you try and go knock on some neighbor's door across the street from where y'all live to play with some of the neighborhood kids, which, of course, leads to you encountering your first dose of good old-fashioned American racism. Your mom was pissed. She gave the guy who said some ugly things to you an earful, whereas your dad had a different bit of advice. He actually said you need to match word for word and occasionally fist for fist, but that's not your nature. It actually led to you conducting what you consider to be your very first social hack. What exactly was that?
Yeah, we moved over there when I was like four in Montana, and it was like, you know, I used to just kind of entertain my parents and parents' friends when we were in Europe. And so I just kind of did the same thing, you know, just kind of became an entertaining guy. People generally tend to like that. And then they kind of forget about being mean to you as easily.
You give one of your first true friends, a guy named John Thomas, credit with helping you really to discover how interesting the world around you was, even in some place like Great Falls. How did he help you out here?
He was an imaginative guy. He loved science fiction like I did. And we kind of gravitated towards each other because of our collective love of science fiction. And, you know, he was listening to a lot of really strange music, you know, that really strange to me at the time. And he would play it constantly all the time. And it took a while for me to kind of realize, oh, this is great, you know, because it was like Art of Noise, which was really weird. And The Smiths, which sounded, I don't know, just very different to like top 40 radio that I was listening at the time. And so, he just kind of kept with it and kept exposing me to stuff. And eventually the band that kind of opened me up to that whole world of music was The Smithereens, which was only slightly related to post-punk. They were more like a kind of like a post-beatnik kind of music. Anyways, I fell in love with those guys. And then, of course, there were like really hot girls that listened to really great, you know, industrial music. And I was like, oh, I love this music. And these girls love this music, too. This is definitely what I like.
You give John a lot of credit in your evolution. You also give credit to one of your teachers around that time, a Mrs. Lydiard. How did she really help you come out of your social shell?
Lydiard was, I mean, she was my orchestra teacher. I mean, she was my only string teacher throughout junior high and through high school. She was the one who taught me violin. She's the one who led the orchestra, put together the music programs for, you know, East Junior High and Great Falls High. So she was just always around. I mean, she was basically just great at keeping shit together, because she had to, she was working with all these kids that were, you know, all over the place. I couldn't imagine what that job would have been like if kids had cell phones. I think it would have been absolutely impossible. But yeah, she just kind of hung in there and believed in me, and, you know, and put up with me, because I was had like a little bit of a fiery disposition. I would talk back a lot and didn't like authority very much, but I hung in there and she hung in there with me, and that was pretty important.
Yeah, I relate to this book on several levels from childhood. The rebel streak is certainly one, and not having the closest relationship with my dad, and maybe it's a generational thing. With your dad, it probably had something to do with the fact that he had served in the military as well, but y'all didn't have the closest relationship. He was closed off. You were obviously not one who was attuned to authority necessarily, which might strike somebody who had been in the military poorly, let's just say. But you maintain that something actually changed for the worse with regards to all of that around the time you were 13. What changed and what happened as a result?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like a combination of me, you know, coming of age and asserting my individuality, and my father's upbringing of being kind of a bit of a disciplinarian, and, you know, just kind of coming to a head where I wasn't into doing stuff that I was supposed to be doing because people were telling me to do it. So when my dad would ask me to do stuff, I started becoming a little bit more resistant to it and questioning why, you know, why do I need to be doing that? And like, I don't know. It was just kind of the perfect storm, you know. And he was, since he grew up in a disciplinarian style, he didn't really know what to do. Like, he didn't have any skills to, you know, it was either like, you do what I say, or like, you know, that's you being good. But someone questioning why, that is something that he didn't know what to do with.
Well, I'm with you, by the way, and this is something that I questioned as a kid like you did. The excuse "because I said so" is BS. Like, let's have a conversation here so I can understand why it is that you want me to do something that you do. Like, even as a parent of a 9 and 7 year old right now, I try really hard, because it's easy to lean on that excuse, but I try really hard to actually explain to them, to let them know, because at that point, it's not, they're not always compliant, but you're going to get a higher percentage of compliance if you can help them understand where you're coming from.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I always appreciated that. I mean, I still do, like, you know, even as an adult, you know, when, for instance, I was on a flight, and, you know, when everybody was boarding, they were putting their stuff in the overhead, and the flight attendant, she said, I need you to put your luggage this way, because, or wheels out, or whatever it was, wheels in, wheels out, whatever, I forget what it is. And she's like, because the wheels take up extra space in the back, and the shape of the thing allows for more, doesn't allow for the suitcase to go deeper, so we can't close it. And so she explained why, and I was like, that's the key. That's the secret. It doesn't always work. Like, some people are just like, you know, but most of the time, intelligent people enjoy it when you're, instead of saying like, do this now, it's like, do it. Could you do this because blah, 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 blah. And then it feels like, oh, that makes sense. I think I'll do that, because that's a good reason why I should, you know?
So the next time I'm sitting next to somebody who decides it's a good idea to take their shoes and socks off mid-flight,
oh,
rather than saying, will you please put your freaking socks and shoes back on? I should say, will you please put your freaking socks and shoes back on, because it's freaking disgusting.
Disgusting. Yes, 100%. That's much, much better. They'll do it immediately and they won't trip at all.
So you and your dad have a sort of final blowout that leads to him leaving the house altogether and moving back to Cleveland. And you do end up visiting him, which we'll get to here in just a little bit, but you conducted a fascinating social experiment on the eve of starting high school. really inspired by the Breakfast Club. What exactly did you set out to do upon entering high school?
Yeah, I mean, high school, you know, I was in junior high, and I think John Hughes's first movie, it might have been his first movie or one of his first movies, 16 Candles came out. And that kind of primed me for his aesthetic and his style. And then when The Breakfast Club came out, it just blew me away. I was, it represented this romantic notion of classism on a teenage scale. And I identified with, you know, a few of those characters, and I loved all of the characters. I thought that they were all interesting. And that was the whole thing about Breakfast Club. It's like that they were all there for a reason. And they were all young, and they shared a lot in common with one another. And I thought that was exciting. I thought it was really cool to, I thought to myself, maybe in high school, I could try to become all of those social classes. And yeah. And so I kind of did it. Like the first year I was like nothing. I played sports. I played football, but I wasn't really a jock. I was just kind of a guy with his two friends, his wrestler friend and his weirdo friend. And then I got into student council, and was a part of that and throwing parties for the school. And then I was, you know, I was also an orc dork, I guess. We never called it that back then, but was an orchestra. I was in art school as an AP art. I was, you know, I was basically all of those things. I was the criminal. I was the jock. I was kind of the preppy guy for a little bit. I was the weirdo. I was the dork. You know, I was all those things. And I loved it because it really made me feel like I was living inside of a film. And I was lucky enough to have those John Hughes films come out exactly at the times that I was living. So it was pretty cool.
Did any one of those roles feel most natural to you?
I would probably say it was between Bender and Ali Sheedy's character is probably where I ended up the most. Just because he was a criminal, but he had a really good heart. And I mean, kind of a criminal. I mean, he called himself a criminal. What he was doing was barely even criminal. But yeah, I mean, like just that mindset of being a little bit of a scoundrel, but having a good heart. And then Ali Sheedy just being really creative and just being unapologetically who she is was great. I mean, a little bit of Anthony Michael Hall's character in that he was smart and compassionate.
Now back to you visiting Cleveland, because your adolescent shape-shifting really intensified as a sophomore, which you admit in this book, but something was missing. So you go and visit your dad that summer, who had moved back home to where he was from in Cleveland. What did you discover in Cleveland that really changed things for you going forward?
Cleveland was always an interesting place to go to because I was going there all my life every other summer. And so I had friends growing up there. There was another Reggie that lived across the street. But when I got a little bit older, like high school age and that type of a deal, you know, it was just being in the Black community was, I'm so appreciative that my parents, you know, made me go spend time with my grandparents in Cleveland, because I was growing up in all white population. I mean, there was like maybe two other Black kids, but we wouldn't really hang out. They were different kinds of kids. And then in high school, I had some, you know, some friends like that were half Thai and half Taiwanese. But that didn't happen until way later. So to be in the Black community was pretty enriching and important to me because, you know, I just wasn't around it. And I got to be exposed to incredible forms of music and different cultural aspects of being who I am. And then, I got to see, my dad took me to go see Music on the Flats down in, it's like a post-industrial area downtown Cleveland. And I got to see Faith No More and a bunch of other weird bands. And my dad took me there. And so, you know, he tried his best to, you know, be cool to me.
We're going to have to fast forward a little bit now. So people just need to go buy the book to find out how you discovered your two favorite drugs, weed and tongue, in the same night, getting kicked out of orchestra your junior year, life taking a major turn at the age of 17. You do eventually graduate and toil for Great Falls a little bit, but you ultimately decide to leave and you move to Seattle. Why did you decide to head to Seattle from Montana?
Well, Seattle was the closest big city from Great Falls. So you could drive to Seattle in 13 hours. Yeah, it just seemed like the most logical place to move. Also, the band Soundgarden, I'd just been turned on to by my friend Mel, and I just immediately fell in love with that band. I thought that they were just mind blowing. So I was stoked to move to a city where they were, you know, operating from. So it was like a combination of practical and some cultural incentive.
And you also started experiencing some serious musical successes in Seattle, first with Hit Explosion, which gave you your first real taste of real money in your entire life. But you say that your fun really began as a musician with the band Maktub. I apologize for not knowing.
Maktub. Yeah.
Maktub. So what was it about Maktub that really started the fun in music for you?
I'd been in some original bands, but Maktub was the first original band that I was in for a while. I think I was in that band for five or 6 years, something like that, 5 years. Yeah, I mean, you know, we created our own style of music. We did everything ourselves. We were very DIY, and we had great people in the band. We, you know, first round, we had a keyboardist, Alex Veeley, who was a total genius, musical genius, and, you know, music historian on soul and R&B. He knew everything, funk and soul. In the next round, we got this guy, Thaddeus Turner, who's an incredible guitar player, and also a little bit of a historian too, but more on the kind of Seattle R&B scene, and Daniel Spills on keyboard. And he was an incredible, just a really good regimented, kind of OCD guy, that helped shape the band and keep it under, financial control. And then also, Kevin Goldman, the bass player, he was also incredible at design and keeping things in check. So the whole band, and then Davis Martin, he started the band. Basically, he put everybody together, and it was an amazing drummer, just like a freaking clock. You know, the guy was unstoppable. And so to be in a band with those people and creating our own music and creating our own little microculture in this and creating a jam scene that hadn't existed there before was pretty incredible.
Admission time for me, Reggie. I am drawn to the comedy side of your story. I'm a big fan of stand-up, and I have the pleasure of speaking with a lot of really talented stand-up comedians who are passing through Austin. You were in Austin not too long ago, headlining at the Mothership. We may talk about that in a sec. First, though, why does Eugene Merman get quite a bit of credit for the start of your comedy career?
Yeah, I mean, Eugene was he was opening for Stella, which is a three-man sketch group that was on tour, and they were selling their DVD that had all their shorts that they had made. And they were the state, or they were former members of the state, I think most of them, except for, I don't think Showalter was actually in the state, but I might be wrong. But anyways, they were on tour, and I fell in love with the state, or at least Wet Hot American Summer. I fell in love with the Stella shorts, and because of a friend who had moved to New York and was exposed to them, brought them back to Seattle. And when they came through to tour in Seattle, Eugene Merman was opening, and this experimental artist, this performance artist that I befriended through the contemporary dance scene in Seattle, who was there, he's from the East Coast, but he was working with a dance group. I befriended him, and he told me about Eugene, because he'd gone to college with Eugene, and how he had a comedy night out there, and that, you know, he was opening for Stella, and that he could introduce me. And so when they came to town, there was a DVD signing at Scarecrow Video. And when I approached when I finally got up to them, the three of them, Michael Showalter, Michael Ian Black, and David Wayne, Michael Showalter recognized me. It's funny. I just saw him yesterday at lunch when I was talking about this very story to these guys that I might be working with on a film. And he just walked by. He stopped and I was like, what? This is impossible. So this is crazy that we're, and he's kind of showing up again. But Michael Showalter recognized me from a gig that I did in New York and pronounced my band's name right, which no one ever does, because why would you? But and I was like shocked. I was like, what? Why does this mastermind comedian know my band? And then I was like, oh, I'll come to your show later. And he's like, great. And so then I went to the show, met Eugene. And Eugene was like, I have this comedy night in New York. If you're ever out there, give me a text. And I'd love to have you on the show. And so I ended up going out to New York not too long after that to work with a band as a singer and songwriter. And I showed up at the gig. I did my stupid little comedy stuff, and everyone really dug it immediately. I just found a new family, like, instantaneously. And so Eugene was very warm about that, and also he introduced me to his booking agent, and she became my booking agent. We went to Fringe Festival together. We were roommates for the Fringe Festival in 2007, so he was kind of a big part of my beginning years, or new beginning years of stand-up.
Had quite the unique path in comedy, and amongst the highlights, that Richard Branson story is hilarious. I know it's more of a footnote than anything else, but what a bizarre place to perform stand-up comedy. But you spent much of 2010 opening for Conan O'Brien on his Live Nationwide tour, which you admit to getting quite a bit of time with Conan backstage as well. What did he teach you about comedy, Reggie?
I would say the thing that he taught me most was how not to be. I think Conan is one of the, I always call him a good king. He never talked down anybody, never treated anybody unfairly. He would definitely razz people in kind of an aggressive way, but everyone knew, you know, that he was kidding. He was very clear about that. So there was definitely some of that, but like he was always good-natured and treated everybody very well, and he didn't bother with security. Like, he didn't have like security guards or anything like that. He just was he's kind of a of the people guy. So when, you know, he'd hang out outside, or when we'd be transferring from, you know, the venue to the bus or whatever, and there'd be people, he'd always take time to hang out with them and have conversations. And I think that's the thing. And he did everything himself. He did his own makeup before going on stage. He was just a very DIY guy, and a weird dude, but also very personable. Also, he grew up Catholic, so we would talk about like Catholic stuff. It was kind of funny, but he was just a cool dude, man. I'm really lucky that I got to go on tour with him. But I would say that's probably the biggest thing, is just don't be a precious dum-dum.
I did want to end with a more serious note on the book. Before that, though, I did want to rewind and ask you about the comedy Mothership, because you did headline there not too long ago. It's obviously been getting rave reviews from audience and comedians alike since it opened in late March. What was your experience like of working the Mothership?
Joe had me come by before I performed, like many, many months before that. And I got to see a tour of it, and was just totally impressed. It's a comedy club that, you know, that a comedian, it's like a dream comedy club that a comedian would want to build. If a comedian could build a comedy club, that's the comedy club that you would build. So structurally, it was sick, like the way it was laid out, everything, the way it functions, the lighting system in the green room is so cool. It just keeps everybody on time, you know, like when you're about to go up and you can see video of both rooms happening in the green room. There's like tons and tons of great THC products. It was pretty great. And for me, I was a little worried because it's the South, you know, and it's like, oh no, I can't, you know, be as weird or, you know, or something like that. I was just like, I was a little worried. So a lot of my sets, I would spend probably half an hour talking about stealth coatings on military aircraft and like the B-21 Raider. it was ridiculous, but that actually did work. So I would talk about like truck suspensions and stuff like that. But you know, once people know you're there for them to have a good time, they're fine. And I really didn't have anything to worry about, but the audiences were great. The room was awesome. Sound was perfect. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. And also I got to see Joe perform some stand-up, which I'd never seen him do live. And he blew me away. He's a great stand-up. I knew he must have been a great stand-up, but also he could have been just a guy that like got into a podcast and got too comfortable, you know. It could have been, but he's an awesome comedian. And I wish that people could see his live show, because he went into a whole thing about him and like anti-vax stuff, where he was like, why would you trust a guy that made people eat bull's penises or whatever, on a TV show about medical advice? He's like, I'm not a doctor. I never asked anybody to trust me. You know, like that little section alone would have like assuaged so many people's like, that's not cool, man. Or that's not responsible. You know, I saw that. I was like, well, that makes, why don't you just put that online? It's just like, this is like completely takes down the pressure, you know? And so people understand who you are. You're a comedian, you know, and you're curious about the world, and your opinion changes when you get more information about stuff. And so anyways, it was a great experience, and he was just an amazing host.
I think that was part of a bit that had to do with Prince Harry. And I love the psychedelic element of that bit too, but people are going to have to wait for him to put it out on video or streaming to find out more. Now, we're at such a great point with stand-up comedy, Reggie, as you're probably well aware, where it's like a sort of golden era where it is so popular right now. But with that means new people coming to shows. And I think a lot of people need to be reminded of certain unwritten rules with regards to attending and participating in a comedy show. For you, as somebody who has done this for so long now, is there any one unwritten rule that you want everybody to understand about going to their first comedy show?
One, I would say, like, don't get too drunk. I think it's a good one. People, you know, it's fine. Have a couple drinks or whatever, but like, don't get drunk. It's like the worst place to lose connection with reality. Cause someone's working and they've like worked really hard at, you know, writing that material. And, you know, you should like give them the time of day. If they're really doing bad, then like, whatever, just like, you don't have to react. You know, you don't have to yell at them or something like that, you know, or even if they are doing well, but you're not understanding what they're doing. It's like, don't yell at the stage. It's just completely unnecessary. I'd say if you're going to your first comedy show, just lay back, relax and listen to what they're saying and be present in the room and have a good time. And obviously research who you're going to see. Hopefully there's like someone that people are excited about seeing. Definitely try to go to a show where people are stoked about who they're about to see, so that you're not like necessarily going on some weird night where somebody comes in and they're like just starting out and they're not quite hitting, and you're like, whoa, this is stand-up comedy. It's like, no, you want to see something good. So yeah, be choosy and then be ready to just lay back and have a good time.
All great pieces of advice. I would expand the don't get too drunk thing, which is don't get too inebriated on anything. Like Rowan was talking a couple weeks ago about somebody falling into a K-hole in the middle of one of the shows, which is an interesting place to have that happen to you.
Yeah, Anxiety City, for sure, because that's a pretty immobilizing experience. Although I think I would probably be the best person to be on stage while someone was having a K-hole.
Oh, is that right? Why?
Just because I'm a huge Ket evangelist, so I'd know where they were coming from and I'd know how to handle it.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate place for that to happen, I guess, if Reggie Watts is not on stage.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. If someone's just like got their list of jokes and they're going through it, it's like, that's not the right place. If it's me, consider it. But even then, you know, you might want to be conscious during the show.
Exactly. All right. Last thing now, Reggie, returning to the book for this final question. I want to thank you for sharing such heartfelt sentiments and memories regarding your mom and how important she was to you. And also you really coping with the idea of her passing years before it actually happened. Now, she did pass away a few years ago, and my condolences to you for that. What is your lasting memory of her?
you know, she, we, you know, we had like a weird relationship in that she was, you know, she was from a generation, I guess she would be a boomer, I think, something like that. She's born in 1938. She was of an older generation that, you know, fought. She had to fight a lot all of her life. She was a fighter, and she fought for her rights as a French citizen, you know, against the Germans as a little girl, and like her family dealing with that and the aftermath of that and the Reconstruction. She was a redhead, you know, so people would like make fun of her for that. She was just different. She protected her brother, who her mother wasn't. She had a terrible relationship with her mother, so she had to fight with her mother and protect her brother against their mother. And then she met my dad, and then, you know, had to fight for the perception of a white woman being with a black man. And at that right time, when civil rights movement was happening in the United States in 69, 68. So her whole life, and then moving to Montana, which is like, it's, I wouldn't say like Montana was like the worst place to move, because it had racism, but it wasn't like institutionalized racism that happens in the South, which has a much different relationship to it. Montana's like, they have racism, but there's no history of it really, functionally. And so it was there, but it was like much, much lighter version, if that makes any sense. But she
Diet
still,
racism, huh?
what's that?
Diet racism, huh?
Yeah, diet racism for sure. It was there. It could have been bad, but my mom was like very ferocious about it and would get up in people's faces. And so I'd say that the lasting thing is that she was a fighter, and she fought for people that she loved, and stood up for people that she thought needed to be stood up for. And she was very equitable in that way. And yeah, she didn't stop, man. She was a hard worker and a fighter. You know, and that's something that fuels me. That's, I think that's why I can do so much, you know, why I can like do a gig over here, then fly over here and do a thing. You know, it's like that working attitude that she had. I think that that's what I got from her, and just treating people fairly.
We are all appreciative of that. He is Reggie Watts, internationally renowned musician, comedian, and writer. Give him a follow on Instagram at Reggie Watts, and make sure to check out his excellent new book. Came out, I want to say, this summer. It's called Great Falls, Montana: Fast Times, Post-Punk Weirdos, and a Tale of Coming Home Again. Reggie, thank you so much for the time today, and thank you for this superb book.
Oh man, my absolute pleasure. It was a great conversation.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. And thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. We'll talk to you next time on Books on Pod.